Hello, everyone, and welcome to another expert interview at the Innovation and Creativity Summit 2017. I'm very happy to have what looks like is going to be a real highlight of the summit. We have Karen Dillon with us today. Karen was a former editor of the Harvard Business Review, one of the most established magazines dealing with business and innovation on the planet, and is also a co-author with Clayton Christensen of a new book on innovation called Competing Against Luck. Karen, it's wonderful having you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So, for people who don't know you and don't know your history, could you just give us a quick insight into how you got involved in innovation?
Sure. So originally by doing, and then laterally by writing about it. I have been a longtime business editor and journalist, and I had along the way in my years at Harvard Business Review the good fortune to work with Clayton Christensen on a few projects. And he and I formed a writing partnership, basically, and he asked me to work on this book with him, Competing Against Luck. And it just, I wanted to because it felt to me like a really important missing piece, something I understood myself from having had many successful and many frustrating efforts at trying to innovate in the various publications that I had worked at over the years. So to me, this felt like something really important to share with people, and I was happy to work on that with Clay as well.
And as I mentioned, you were the editor of the Harvard Business Review for many years. And I personally read HBR quite frequently to get other people's insights into how they're doing innovation at their own companies and the thought leadership behind it. But one thing I want to ask you is, during your time there, did you see any sort of trend or evolution around the concept of innovation and what people were writing about?
I think if you look back literally decades, you'll find a common thread of frustration about innovation. I mean, really into the 60s, where companies were frustrated, CEOs were frustrated with their company's efforts. So there have been waves of trends, the things that were going to be the next big thing. And it's not that they're not helpful. I just don't think they any of them have completely changed the game. The most recent one that people point to and think about and think can solve their problems is data and analytics. Somewhere we must have the ability to scientifically get together all the bits of information to understand perfectly what customers want to buy, where, when, and how, under what circumstances. And yet, McKinsey did a survey just a couple years ago of leading global CEOs, and the vast majority of them, though they will tell you that innovation is a top priority, the vast majority of them will say they're unsatisfied with their company's innovation efforts. It feels like it should be a scientific process, but that's not what's happening, and it's not quite right yet for most companies. So it continues, as it was in the 60s, to be a frustration that CEOs and organizations all around the world are still trying to fix.
Is that because you think there isn't really this common understanding of what innovation actually is?
I think there are a lot of causes for it, but yes, I think at the core of it, people are improving understanding, but they're not yet getting to what we call the causal mechanism, the real core of what causes what to happen, what causes anybody, a customer, to decide to purchase this over that. And until you understand that specifically, I think innovation will always be and feel very hit or miss.
Now, one thing I'd like to ask your views on, which is something that HBR published a lot on and Clayton Christensen did essentially brought to light for a lot of people, is this theory of disruptive innovation. Because it's really one of the most popular concepts out there, especially in Silicon Valley, where every company mantra seems to be, we're going to disrupt the market and become successful by it. What's your view on how people understand disruption versus what it's actually meant to show?
Well, it's a great word, and it's very powerful. Disrupt, it feels like a rally cry, and people like it to be their strategy. We're going to go out and disrupt the giant. And there's a lot of appeal to the idea that a kind of underdog can do that. But what Clayton would say is that the theory of disruption is very specific and has just been overly used and very generically used and lost its original meaning. The theory is that we know we can predict in advance what incumbent companies, giant big companies, will do in the face of competition from a small upstart. One of the best simple examples, obviously, is Blockbuster and Netflix. You know, what did Blockbuster do in the face of competition from Netflix? Blockbuster ignored it and started trying to figure out ways to make more and more money by adding and layering services for its existing companies. We know that almost always leads to that incumbent company falling off the cliff. So the theory of disruption actually predicts the behavior of the incumbent giant company, doesn't tell you how or what the disruptive company discovered to create or do to find that Achilles heel. And so for years, for 20 years, Clay's been working on the complement to the theory of disruption, which is, so how do you know what to invent or create so that it will be successful? There's a reason that venture capital companies expect, you know, only 3 of 10 or only 2 of 10 to come back with returns. It's because they do feel like it's hit or miss. If you knew, you would only invest in the companies that were going to be successful disruptors. So Clay has spent 2 decades in search of what's the causal mechanism for getting that innovation right, understanding your customers well enough to get it right. And that's what he thinks, and we've shared, is what we call the theory of jobs to be done.
And this is something you cover in the new book, which I just happen to have here as well, Competing Against Luck. So can you tell us about what do you mean by competing against luck and this concept of jobs to be done?
Sure. So as I talked about, the kind of feeling that innovation is still frustratingly hit or miss. You might get close, you might not. A lot of companies have budgets, and some of it they know is just try things. You know, you hope one of them hits. That isn't really a good enough innovation strategy. That is depending on luck. We think you don't have to rely on luck. You can compete against those who are relying on luck if you understand the causal mechanism. And in a really simple way, what we think that is, the reason people make the choices to buy or bring a product or service into their life, one over the other or nothing at all, is not because they want that product or even how great the features and benefits are on that product. It's because they're trying to solve a frustration or challenge in their life. They're trying to make progress with something they're struggling with. We call that a job. They have a job they're trying to accomplish, and they hire something to do the job for them. And that may sound just like a simple language change, but we mean something very specific with job. And I think when you think about that, your product or innovation through the lens of jobs, it will make a big difference in what matters. We think there's a very important, not just functional component, what does this product do or service do, but there's a social component. What does this make me feel about the people around me and how I'm seen? And there's an emotional component. How does this make me feel? What am I trying to accomplish? That a job is about making progress in specific circumstances, not just generically, with social, emotional, and functional components. And those are all very important to getting the job done and getting hired for the job.
And so I think a lot of people right now are listening to you, and it seems a bit abstract. I think what might be useful is, can you give us an example of how a company might use this concept and this overarching theory and actually translate it into the way they produce new innovations?
Sure. I'll give you a really simple example that struck me as really profound because it completely mirrored something that was in my own life. There is a case we talk about in the book of a construction company that was trying to sell nice condominium units in the greater Detroit area in what was effectively a downturn, and is not now, but a few years ago. And though they were building beautiful units and they had lots of people coming in and they were priced competitively and they kept having focus groups and asking, what could we do to improve these? They were not selling a lot of condos. They were really stuck, and they'd get people in. What would you like to see? The whole checklist of things. Granite countertops, they put granite countertops in. Chrome appliances, they put chrome appliances in. Now I'm just thinking of all the features and benefits any company would think of adding to its product. They made these condos really nice, but people still, though they'd come look, they weren't buying. So instead of doing focus groups for prospective buyers, they changed and put on what we'll call the jobs to be done lenses on. And they asked people who had actually made the purchase and moved in, tell me about how you got to the decision to decide to buy this condo and move in. And everybody had a different story, and there wasn't a clear demographic or geographic or even psychographic, but this one weird clue kept coming up. A lot of people talked about when they figured out what to do with their dining room table, then they were finally free to move. And they were thinking, that's a strange thing. Who cares? And mostly they were older people, and they were old dining room tables that should go to charity probably. But then they clicked with the dining room table isn't about the function of eating and having space to eat. We have beautiful granite countertops and you can host in a different way. The dining room table for those people deciding to move was symbolic of family and tradition and the home our family had lived in. So getting rid of the dining room table was a really big deal. It was kind of akin to leaving your family behind. So the condo developer rethought everything when they had that insight. Where people aren't buying homes, we're helping them move lives. So when you think about selling, helping you move lives versus buying a home, you're not going to necessarily add more bells and whistles. You're going to think about all the social and emotional pieces that come with that. What they did is they made the second bedroom 20% smaller, so technically you could fit a dining room table in if you wanted to. They also created free on-site storage for 2 years and a sorting room so that you didn't have to make all the decisions before you moved about keeping children's artwork and cards and, you know, notes from grandma. That could come with you if you needed to, if you weren't ready to give up that stuff and take your time. And then they offered free moving services. They raised the prices of the condo, which more than paid for the moving services and the storage, and they increased sales by 25% in a down market. Those things were not about making the condo units better. It was about helping people with the job of help me move my life in emotional and social context, which was really important. I think that's a simple way of thinking about the job that doesn't involve adding features or technology. It's about having a better understanding of what's causing people to make the choice and what anxieties come into play at that same time.
I think that's it's a beautiful, fascinating example, because as you mentioned, it's not about making a product better per se in the traditional sense of improving the list of features that already exist. And when I'm talking with clients about innovation and asking them how they approach innovation, quite often they'll list out they want to see improvement every year in performance, in cost, in material usage, but it's always taking the current product and making it better by some criteria which already exist there. And what you're suggesting is you flip the concept on its head, and it's not about the product itself, it's about what the people buying the product get from it.
Yes. If all of that improvement can be channeled towards doing the job better, but that's not necessarily channeled towards cooler and better. You know, it's a constant tension with technology, the technology group and the R&D people. Things can be made better from all of those perspectives. That doesn't mean it does the job better. And in fact, if you laden a product or service with too many bells and whistles that don't address the job, you just confuse the consumer and you're not the clear choice for them anymore. And you actually risk, in some ways, by making it so much better from your perspective, you risk confusing them about whether or not you solve their job and they turn elsewhere for a solution.
So you mentioned the way you get these insights to figure out what the jobs to be done actually are. The focus groups just didn't seem to work very well as a method of getting that insight. Would you suggest that's generally the case?
We say it's certainly a tool for people, but it's not, we don't think it's the one that will get at the causal mechanism, and I think people rely on it. First of all, it's artificial. You bring people in and you ask them all kinds of things about what they care about or what matters to them. You know, how many of you listeners care about the environment? Every single one of us cares about the environment, right? Hands up. Now, if I opened all your cabinets, would that tell me that that was true? Are there cleaning products that aren't environmentally sound? If you're a parent and you bought diapers, we think that you can only really understand a job yet watching the person or talking to someone in context of the struggle, what they're trying to achieve, and usually or typically after they've made a choice, so that you can understand and dissect the choice rather than what they might like to think of themselves as doing or see themselves as doing. So yes, focus groups, again, a tool, not one we think will get at the causal mechanism, which we think is the whole Megillah.
So the million-dollar question is, what sort of advice do you have on finding out the causal mechanism? And what do you mean by the causal mechanism at a fundamental level?
It's what literally is triggering you to decide to buy something or not. We might all like to say that we care about certain things or we want something things, but really what's going on deep inside, what are all the factors that you may not even be able to articulate, but that your behavior would help us identify as what is making you make the choice in the moment of truth. We actually think there are two critical moments, by the way, the moment you hire it, the big hire we call it, and the little hire when you actually start to use it. Those are both important, and it's sort of easier to get people on the big hire and much more important to get them routinely on the little hire if you're going to be successful. But it's sort of, no matter what you would tell people or even tell yourself, there's some kind of internal alchemy going on with all of those components. The emotional one is really powerful. The anxiety of switching away from a product or service that you're kind of comfortable with, even if it's imperfect, is really strong. So if a new product or service is kind of better, a little bit better, that's not good enough. That's not going to lure people away with that huge anxiety barrier of getting away from the thing that they're already kind of wedded to in all its imperfections. So you're looking for, can you kind of diagram all of the things that are going on in that moment of choice that you can take advantage of as an innovator so that you can try to have a better solution to it. We're very clear that there's no one way to do this, but There are lots of things that you can do to get closer to understanding your customers' jobs to be done. You're basically looking for struggles. You know, what are they struggling with? What are they struggling to accomplish? And putting up with imperfect solutions, because there is nothing better on the market. We know that in general, if your solution to a job to be done is not significantly better to the existing alternatives, you're probably not going to win people over. So saying you're 20% faster, unless that's a huge advantage to people's job to be done, that's probably not going to be it. But when you see people who are going to crazy workarounds to try to make something else work, or literally doing without, not taking a product or service into their lives at all, rather than accept one of those inferior solutions, then you've identified an opportunity that might be very fertile for you to develop a better solution to their job to be done.
It's something that I deal with when I'm talking to people as well. It's one of the main questions companies face is, why aren't customers reacting the way that we expect them to when we're offering them a better product? And one of the things I talk about is perceived value, because perceived value is all from the perception of the customer. And they're not just looking at the one offering from this one company. There's everything else out there in the market. And as you say, there's things that they're already using where there might be a performance improvement if they were to start from scratch again. But a lot of people have this sort of embedded view of what the competition's already offering or what they're already using themselves.
There's something I've heard routinely when we were doing interviews for the book and in my own experience that frustrated, understandably frustrated, innovators would say, we just have to better educate our customers on what we're offering. That's the only problem here. That's the only reason it hasn't been, you know, growing really quickly. I think if you have to work hard to educate your customers on why your product is better, you've already lost. There's something that Clay calls a purpose brand, and that's the gold standard. You want to be associated, your brand, your product or service, to be associated with the job to be done, so that customers don't even think to look around for another solution. They just automatically hire you. Google, right? Everybody, to go on, do a quick search for information, Google is a purpose brand. That's what you want. The moment your customers start having to value, compare, and shop to other products or services, you're already on the back foot, because you are not now the one that they will default to. We believe that if you identify the job to be done well and you solve it better than anybody else by a mile, you can actually charge premium prices. You build sustaining competitive advantage, and you can charge premium prices. It's really a win if you get it right in the beginning, that you can sustain for a long time.
Do you have any other case studies? I love the one about the construction company, but have you got another case study covered in the book about a company that was struggling and then changed the way they looked at the innovation challenge?
We have lots. I recommend the book for people, but one of my favorites is a college here, a university in the United States called Southern New Hampshire University, SNHU. Some of your international listeners may have heard of it, may not have, but it's a typical American university. It's been around, I'm going to say, for almost 100 years, small in New Hampshire, small campus, liberal arts, kind of generic, and it was really struggling. And it was at the stage where similar colleges here in America were starting to go bankrupt or really be in deep financial difficulty. And it was in a similar situation where they didn't see where their growth was going to come from. They knew exactly who their competitors were, the same as they had been for decades and decades, the local universities. And it was really hard to think, how are we going to do better? How are we going to grow if we're not just simply raising our prices, raising tuition? Then they had this kind of click moment where they realized they had this tiny little online division, they called it distance learning, that they had literally almost ignored. It was often a far part of campus, and students could sign up and take classes from, you know, their homes, wherever they were. And then they started to process, what's the job to be done of those students versus the students who come to campus? And it turns out, they didn't even have to think about it too long, it became very clear that most students who are coming to campus are 18. It's what they call the coming of age experience. They want climbing walls, and they want to have cappuccinos with their professors and talk about the meaning of life. And it's a really immersive come of age experience. The students who were doing that distance learning had a completely different job to be done. And all the things that you would put in place to support the coming of age students meant nothing to the distance learners. The distance learners, by and large, were people who were coming back to education after an earlier aborted attempt at some point in their life. They might be in their 30s. They might be logging on to their computer to take a class or do some homework at 10 o'clock at night or 11 o'clock at night. They've had all the coming of age they need, Now they just, the job to be done for them was, I want a better job, or I want credentials that will get me to a better place in life because I want a better life. So when you put on the lenses of jobs to be done for that job, for that group of customers, it's a totally different group than the generic coming of age. Once you realize that, Southern New Hampshire University changed many, many things so that they could completely focus on the job for distance learners. For example, when in the old days, and that's maybe 10 years ago, if you wrote away for information from Southern New Hampshire University and you were a distance learner, you might get a letter in 2 weeks and some information. If you wanted to find out, is there financial aid available for your for you, they might, you know, let you release the records or give you permission to release your records. And then it would take a month or 2 months or 3 months to find out if you qualify. By that point, you're probably applying for a different job. You know, the help me get a better job is not competing with all the other universities in America. It's competing with anything else that will help me stand out. So they changed everything so that they had rapid response. They had different rules and regulations for how students interacted with professors. They figured out a way to get all those answers for financial aid and basic information. Literally, they respond to an email within, I think it's 10 minutes, and then within 24 hours, you get answers on the rest of that stuff. They described it as a schematic from a nuclear diagram, but all of the parts of their historic processes that had to change so that they would fit that distance learner. Long story short, it is one of the most financially and sort of name brand recognition now in the state, successful universities of the past 5 or 10 years. It's a really big success story. And that's from a college you've never heard of that was on a sleepy New Hampshire campus and was absolutely having difficulty surviving. And it's now growing at huge double-digit revenue rates. And Obama mentioned it as one of the most biggest innovation success stories in education a few years ago. It's been a terrific success story simply by rethinking about the job to be done.
Again, love that quote. And I've got a copy of the book, as you saw earlier. I'm going to go through it and figure out some of the other case studies for myself. But I'd like to go back to one of the things you talked about earlier and one of the things that we talked about before we started recording the session, which is helping companies figure out who they're actually competing against. Because partially it's about convincing a customer that your job to be done will, that your offering will fix the job they have to be done. But what about the situations where the customer has multiple very, very different ways that they can address these jobs?
Well, that's a good question to ask yourself to start with. Who are we really competing with? And if your answers are quickly all companies or organizations or products or services that are exactly in the same category as you, and if that's the only way you track your progress is gaining market share against companies like you, you probably don't have, we think, a clearly identified job to be done, and then you're in trouble. If you start to put on the lenses of jobs to be done and think really holistically about what are people hiring us to do, it should change your competitive landscape dramatically and that thus change what you do to improve your product or service or even market it or talk about it. I'll give you a quick example. In what universe are all of these products competing? Sony PlayStation, bottle of wine,
okay.
In my house, a pint of Haagen-Dazs, or a SoulCycle gym class or going to the gym?
I would guess in a young woman who has free time.
It's anything, I'm just making this up, but yeah. Anything to help me relax after a day of work. I'll throw in Netflix in there. And this is something that Reed Hastings, the founder of Netflix, is very clear about. Netflix is not, he was asked a question by John Doerr, the venture capitalist, about a year ago, I think it was, at some kind of a seminar, and John Doerr said, how are you competing with Amazon Prime? How are you feeling about that? And his answer was, we're competing with anything you do to relax. We're competing with a bottle of wine, and in fact, that may be our toughest competition. It's not that you're obviously going to go, you know, position yourself next to bottles of wine in the wine store, but if you realize what a person is trying to accomplish when they click on a Netflix or they open a bottle of wine, or do both. You'll think about what you do and add and how you can innovate to better solve that job to be done way better than if you think you're just competing against Amazon Prime. If it's Amazon Prime, you might just be fighting over the selection of movies. If you realize it's a bottle of wine, you're going to make sure it's really easy and fast to click something up on your TV screen and the quality is good and that it doesn't take a long time for it to spool up or whatever. All those different things that would make it so appealing to just open a wine and we'll talk. If you think through the lens of jobs to be done, you'll value and prioritize different things in your innovation than you would if you're simply thinking about competing against all companies in your exact same category.
I think I've got a similar example, and I hope I'm not misquoting, but I think it was Lego who were asked, who's your biggest competition out there? And they were expecting Mattel and Hasbro and the Transformers line of toys. And whoever was being asked that, one of the execs, they mentioned some of the other toy companies, but they also mentioned the park. They mentioned television. They mentioned video games. They mentioned football. And it's basically anything that involves the children having time to themselves to play or books to read. So it's a completely different way of thinking about how you propose your value offering. And that's fundamentally what innovation is.
That's perfect. That's a perfect example. And in that case, it's probably, I instantly put my parent cap on thinking, so if I'm a parent, I want the Lego, I want to buy the Legos because I feel like it's way better than my kids turning on the television. And so if you understand that's a job from probably the purchaser of the Legos, big hire, little hire is going to be the kid. You need to appeal to both of them. The kid has to want to play with it, but the parent has to want to buy it in the first place. Yes, that's a great example. And those are really important things to understand when you're putting together your offering. That all of those things are competition, and you can't just sweep it away, because in the real world, people will make choices based on the real job, not just based on what lines up better than the other thing on the toy store aisle.
I'd like to quickly ask you about this big hire, little hire concept. And the reason I do is in a lot of large companies, you get top-down decisions on what the people should be using on the ground. And that sounds like an example of when a company introduces a new IT system or a new way of working, the people who made the decision have one view on what it's going to be doing in a company, but the people on the ground, you unfortunately go into large multi-billion dollar companies where people are still sending spreadsheets to each other as the means of keeping accounts consolidated and all of these workarounds.
It's really true. It gets complicated when you have somebody making the purchasing decision that's different than the users, and you have to take all of those stakeholders into account. You have to at least neutralize stakeholders. You can't have negatives in it because it will not be successful if the people on the ground don't really use it. We've seen lots of examples of this. I'll give you a quick one off the top of my head. The Apple iBooks, the ones that they're going to schools, that is way better technology than a Chromebook. And from a budget perspective, it's more expensive, but you can argue that there's so much more you can do with those. But for the people making the purchasing decision, it's cheaper to buy Chromebooks and bring them into the classroom. And guess what? The IT guy who has to implement all of that stuff, it's easier for him to have something that doesn't require him to worry about apps going off campus or kids getting viruses and things like that. So Chromebooks have done much better in American education systems than Apple, even though the technology is generally considered to be far superior from the Apple products. It's because the people who make the decisions might understand that technology is better, but the people who have to use it, the little higher and implement it, if it's overwhelming to them, they're not going to use it and it will fail. So yes, you have to make sure both of those groups understand the value for both sets of the purchaser and the user have to be at least neutral or positive for it to be successful, or you'll be failing right out of the gate.
Karen, I think this jobs to be done theory is going to be one of the highlights of the summit, because it's only just come out. The book only came out very recently, and so it's hot off the presses as far as a new way of thinking about innovation goes. We're coming up to the end of the interview, unfortunately. But one thing I'd like to ask you is, if you've got one piece of advice, one tip, one actionable insight that people can actually try out to get more value out of their innovation programs, what would you recommend they do?
I would recommend that you start with the assumption that you don't know everything, even though you think you do. You think you understand the customer. If you think right now you can write down the job to be done, I'm going to tell you from my own experience, you're probably wrong. You probably have brought all kinds of preconceptions to it. Until you talk to real people who have actually made the decision to purchase your product or service or someone else's and really go in with the most open mind possible, you're probably going to already have biased it to what you think the answer should be. I did it all the time as the editor of Harvard Business Review. I was sure I knew what readers would want with X or Y, and sometimes it succeeded and sometimes it didn't. Until you actually walk in the shoes of the person making the choice and really understand the full context, again, emotional and social, really important, you're never going to get it right. So I would start by assuming you don't know, and then start to ask and talk to real people without bringing preconceived notions into that conversation.
Wonderful. We're going to get links down to all your resources below the video here as well. Could you just quickly let people know if they go to your website there, what sort of things they can find?
There's just a little bit of information about this and other books that I have written, and links to Amazon, et cetera, to purchase the book. And you can follow some blogs and interviews I've written. This is a little more information on this idea and others, just to get you started. And it will lead you to other things as well.
Karen, it's been absolutely wonderful having you here. Thank you so much. And thanks for being part of the summit. And I look forward to speaking with you soon. Yeah.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Nick.
Congratulations on being part of the Innovation and Creativity Summit. I'm sure that if you continue to watch the other expert interviews, you will experience an improvement in your capability to turn your ideas into something valuable. But don't forget, to get the very best experience and ensure you don't miss any of the priceless lessons, you should invest in yourself with the All Access Pass. Not only will this give you exclusive lifetime access to watch all the lessons whenever is best for you, you will also get all the interviews as downloadable audio files so you can learn on the go, full transcripts so you can read and analyze the great advice and tips, and exclusive bonuses not available to anyone else. Click the link below to get your All Access Pass now.